Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1 p.m. and today is February 26th. So today was a reasonably quiet day on the majority of markets, but the big move that we saw today was in the pound. The pound was up over a cent against the euro, but it is looking increasingly likely that it is now completing this base formation that's been underway for more than 18 months. What I find particularly interesting is that despite the fact that the tone of the commentary on Brexit has continued to intensify as the range of options has narrowed, in the simple fact of the matter is that the most volatility we've seen in the pound has been was back in 2016, and we've had a reasonably quiet period where the rate has been ranging between 110 and 115 now for a year and a half. But quiet periods in the market give way to periods of greater volatility, and great volatility gives way to quieter periods. So, having completed one, we're entering another. That seems to be the logical conclusion here. When we think about the potential, short-term potential is that they are going to extend the deadline. What's interesting is that the EU wants to extend the deadline all the way out to 21 months because they would like the UK to have another election and then potentially a change of government and a cancellation of the Brexit question entirely. On the other hand, Theresa May is thinking about July. So she still is holding on to the hope, potentially vain hope, of in fact getting a deal across the line or getting some sort of change to the deal that would make it more amenable to her party. They have, but the reality is that any deal that is eventually passed by Parliament is going to amount to membership in all but name. So that is probably not something that a lot of people are going to be happy with. But what it does do is increase the potential that the pound is not going to be subject to the kind of volatility that it was back in 2016. Of course, there are going to be an awful lot of very ticked off people, and that means that the next general election, whenever it happens, is likely to be a cause of volatility for both the markets and for the currency. So in the short term, it does look like we're going to see additional strength in the pound. And that's also relevant against the US dollar. The pound today was up by 1.6 cents. So it has pushed on to a new recovery high. We don't have quite the same clear base formation evident against the dollar, but it is now back above the trend mean. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and as long as it holds this move above 130, we can give the benefit of the doubt to additional upside. Well, I think it's worth considering that generally speaking, when the pound has weakened, it has acted as a boost to the stock market, at least in nominal terms. The FTSE was in negative territory in here today, but it was well off its lows. It's right in the region of its trend mean. The FTSE 250, which I think a lot of UK investors are more interested in because it's more of a domestic play and has outperformed considerably over the last decade, has unwound its oversold condition relative to the trend mean, and it was in positive territory in here today. Removing a source of uncertainty for UK businesses has got to be good news. So there is the potential that the FTSE 250 will outperform the FTSE 100 just by virtue of the fact that by removing that source of uncertainty, it should be generally positive. When we look at the incredible advance that we saw in China yesterday, then it was perhaps inevitable that we get some pause and consolidation. But the most important fact is that the more than year-long downtrend has been broken. It now has plenty of room in which to consolidate. The fact that the banks have been leading on the upside is a rather impressive feat, although they were in negative territory in here today, but we certainly have plenty of room in which to consolidate. When we think about the H share index, it's been ranging for the better part of a decade, and it has now cleared at that 11,000 level, and it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. I think we are probably due a little consolidation, but this does look like a very meaningful event. And as long as the outlook for the trade war, or I guess the negotiations on trade with the USA continue to improve, then the likelihood is that we're going to see a rebound in Chinese assets. And I think that's probably also rather good news for Australia. But when we look at the ASX 200, it has rallied very impressively, and a short-term overbought condition has replaced the short-term oversold condition, so it's quite likely we're going to get at least some pause and consolidation in here. The Australian dollar was in more positive territory in here today. Generally speaking, it was a weak day for the dollar, not in a particularly dynamic manner, but it has now taken 3 days to unwind the downside key reversal we saw 4 days ago on the Aussie dollar. So it's now testing the 72 cent level. That's probably the first area of potential resistance. When we look at the weekly chart, well, it's very clear that it has been encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean on repeated occasions. So that's obviously a barrier over which it's going to have to jump if we're going to move back to an Aussie dollar demand-dominated environment. What I find particularly interesting, particularly when we look at the outlook for the dollar, is the fact that the two-year yield has been distributing below the trend mean now for the better part of 8 weeks. This obviously was a one-way trade all the way from the end of 2017 until the end of 2018, and we've had the first meaningful pullback. But the much bigger question is, what is the likely trajectory of US interest rates? The two-year yield is assuming that it's going to be 2.5% at some point within or between now and 2021. But what the bond market is increasingly pricing in is that the next meaningful move is going to be down. The Fed funds rate now is at 2.5%. So what the two-year yield is pricing in fact, is no move on the upside over the course of the next 2 years. So I think that's a rather important conclusion that the bond market has reached. What it also suggests, and I'm not quite sure why that hasn't worked, but let me see if I can pull this up again. No. Well, that index I was just trying to type in was Morgan Stanley's way of assessing the outlook for the potential for interest rates to advance, and it appears that they have removed it from the public arena, so that's news to me at least. Well, when we think about what is likely, then a lot is going to depend on how well do markets do. Then we have to consider how well the economy does. One, I think, significant factor is that if we are going to have a better, or if there is going to be a deal between China and the USA on terms of trade, we have to at least consider that there has been a massive inventory build over the course of the last 6 months in anticipation of higher tariffs. If that does not in fact occur, then that inventory is going to have to get liquidated and sold off over time. Well, what it suggests is that we've borrowed from the future in terms of demand. And that's the kind of figure that is likely to roll through on a quarter-over-quarter basis, particularly if we go about 6 months out from now. So it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we could start to see year-over-year figures, particularly from the middle of this year and onwards looking not particularly impressive in terms of corporate demand for goods and imports because of that massive inventory build that happened primarily in the last quarter of last year. So what we could have is a more volatile environment on the stock market. The counter argument to that is that the Federal Reserve is not going to be raising rates any further, and they are still working out what they're going to do with the balance sheet. But it's been my conclusion over the course of the last 6 months that they're probably about halfway done. It's going to be very difficult for the Federal Reserve to reduce the size of the balance sheet beyond about 3.5 trillion. It's dropped below 4 trillion at the last reading. So the and we can also say, for example, that the pace of the advance does appear to be speeding up. If we look at that on a log scale, then it hasn't really done much, but it does look like there is a very clear trend here. Well, when Jay Powell was talking back in December, what he was very clear to say was that the pace of the balance sheet runoff was not set in stone. But so far, there is no evidence that they've stopped reducing the size of the balance sheet. So, against the background where the Treasury yield is at 2.5%, so there is no prospect really in the in prices at the moment that there's going to be an additional rate hike. What investors are paying less attention to is that the Federal Reserve is still reducing the size of its balance sheet. But of course, there is also the expectation that they're going to be done by the end of this year. If they persist in $50 billion a month in terms of reducing the size of the balance sheet, they'll be at 3.5 billion by December. Well, when we start to add together the monetary base, the quantity of mortgage bonds that they have acquired, and then also the excess reserves posted by banks, then we start to come up to a figure that's very close to 3.5 trillion, and it's going to be very difficult for the Federal Reserve to go very much beyond that. Well, what that suggests is that we are going to be in a permanently large balance sheet environment. So the pace of liquidity provision is certainly moderating in the USA, but it's not going to disappear entirely. I think that is perhaps one of the greatest conclusions that we have. If we are indeed going to get a trade détente or at least an agreement, then that should be really rather positive for the global economy, and there is the potential that we get a reflation trade. That's, I think, what is coming through in terms of the performance of the stock market. And the Dow Jones is pushing back above the 26,000 point level where it encountered resistance between October and December. It's a very similar story for the S&P 500. It's pausing right now in at the region of 2,800. Well, there's a lot of people who have been raising cash. That is definitely something that's been coming through in terms of the sentiment that I've been witness to from talking to lots of different types of investors over the course of the last few months. There's a number of family offices and also from the, I guess, the way that people are looking at their trusts from the Nevada Trust Company, where I'm a director, there's definitely been more demand for cash items. That's creating demand for treasury management services. It's creating demand for short-term treasury instruments because people are willing to put their they're happy at least to put their cash to work and receive a couple of percent in terms of their return while they're waiting for a clearer signal on what to do. Well, there's obviously been a very significant rebound since December, but as with any rebound from a very oversold condition like this, then it's mostly driven by short covering in the first instance, and then you get some bargain hunting starting to come through. but there's still a lot of cash on the sidelines. And it's rather difficult to get back into the market if the price is above where one made the decision to sell, because that would be to very clearly admit to oneself that you've made the wrong decision. So that generally tends to stay the hand of people in terms of putting money back to work. It's only if we were to see the price starting to move back above 2900 that would really start to panic people, that the market would be at a new all-time high, and then we could see some money starting to come off the sidelines and back into the market. One of the reasons for that, of course, would also be because the yields that are available on cash may not be permanent. And certainly when we look at the 10-year treasury, well, it has so far been pretty steady. But the one thing it has not done has seen the yield push back above the trend mean. So if the 10-year yield starts to come back below the 2.5% level, well, on the one hand, that will be, I think, clearly coinciding with the perspective that we are not going to have an inflationary outcome. But it would also probably be starting to price in that we are moving back into a liquidity-rich environment. When we pay close attention to what's going on in terms of the central bank assets, then it's been really very steady. Certainly, it was contracting all the way through until the end of November, and then it started to improve in December. Well, the market didn't really start to pick up again until the end of December, so we're getting a little bit of a lead indicator here, and it is starting to steady once more. Well, of course, it is still below the 20 trillion level. If it can push back above 20 trillion, well, then we're starting to talk about an uptrend, and that would be, I think, a welcome scenario from the perspective of asset or investors in just about all assets. One of the things that Jay Powell said today was that there are conflicting signals, and certainly I think that is the case, that we have the fact that bond yields are starting to price in a rate cut, and there's only one real reason why the Federal Reserve would cut rates, and that's because they're worried about the economy. And we know, for example, that there is a significant uptick in delinquencies in auto loans, for example, and also among student borrowers. So those are things that are out there on the horizon. We know that there is a lot of debt that needs to be refinanced over the course of the next 3 years, so that's also out there on the horizon. The fact that GE is moving aggressively to tackle its debt load is certainly a positive for the investment grade sector, and now the share has not quite doubled, but not far off it off its lows. And it is now right in the region of the trend mean. Well, I think it still has a lot of work to do, but it does not look like it is going to go bust. And as long as it is tackling its debt, it's probably unlikely it's going to be downgraded either. So if we see more actions by some of the most heavily indebted lower investment grade companies, then that should avoid the fallen angels scenario that a lot of people were talking about at the end of last year. Of course, that's probably not going to save PetSmart, for example. And that is a company that is already squarely in the high yield bracket. It's got a lot of convertible debt, and that debt is currently yielding around 17%. There's, if we're thinking about the kinds of companies that are not going to survive the next economic downturn, well, we don't really have to look very far to think about what those might be. We're still in a broadly ranging environment in terms of the stock market, and as long as that range persists, well, then that suggests that the bullish and bearish arguments are relatively in equilibrium. One of the factors that is helping to control inflation is the fact that commodity prices have generally been ranging over the course of the last almost 3.5 years. The continuous commodity index has been pulling back from the region of the trend mean in here this week. Part of the reason for that is because of the weakness in the oil price. Gold, on the other hand, has been reasonably steady. And in fact, this is really very steady action against a background where people tend to anticipate that gold will be very volatile. So far, this range that's starting to form following the downward dynamic four sessions ago is relatively similar size to the last two, and that's a rather impressive consistency characteristic in the region of the upper side of what is basically a 6 to 7 year range. Where we are seeing weakness in the commodity complex is in a number of the soft commodities. Wheat prices are pulling back in a violent manner. And this has now broken the sequence of higher reaction lows and greatly increases the potential that we're going to go right back down and test the lower side of the range. Coffee, or most particularly Arabica coffee, has also broken on the downside and is at new reaction lows. And this is the first time in a significant period that coffee prices have been below a dollar. So this is a meaningful breakdown, and we are in really virgin territory here, that it's going to need a very clear upward dynamic and break back above the trend mean that's sustained for more than a week in order to question the downward bias. When we look at the Robusta contract, we don't have quite the same amount of back history since it was reformulated, but it hasn't quite been as weak as Arabica, but neither is it particularly strong. And then when we look at sugar prices, obviously both the coffee price and the sugar price are influenced by what happens in terms of the Brazilian economy and the real, but sugar has been attempting to build support over the course of the last 3 or 4 months, but it is pulling back in here today. Then, while cocoa is not especially influenced by either of those, it has also been attempting to build support, but it really does need to break up and away from this volatile ranging phase that's been evolving for the last 6 months. When we look at soybeans, there was initial optimism that the price would do better if China starts buying U.S. product again, but it is barely steady in the region of the trend mean, and this is towards the lower side of the range. And when we look at that on a longer term basis, one of the clearest characteristics we've seen in a significant number of the commodities is that once they broke up and away from those long volatile ranges that began in the early 70s and persisted through until the mid to late 2000s, was that they held the breakouts. Well, if they can't hold the recent lows, then we won't be able to say that any longer. And there is a realistic possibility that that might be the case, that the supply of commodities has increased substantially. If commodity prices start, or soft commodity prices continue to trend downwards, that will sap some of the populist fervor that we have out there in the world. Keeping food prices under control is certainly one of the things that blunts the activity, or the, I guess, the causal factors behind popular revolutions. But to the extent that soft commodities have been reasonably weak, the industrial resources have been really quite steady, and the LME Metals Index has broken back above its trend mean. The FTSE 350 Mining Index, which has been resurgent over the course of the last 6 weeks, is now right in the region of the 20,000 level. One consideration that's worth, I think, paying attention to is the role that Vale's problems had in supporting the prices for the UK listed iron ore miners. Well, Vale has bounced a little in here, but it still needs to push back above the trend mean, whereas Rio Tinto is right in the region of its previous peak, and we could get some consolidation here at the upper side of this almost decade-long range. But if that reaction is relatively shallow, then that will, I think, increase the potential that we could see a run back towards the peak. And we'd rather have to go back. 2008 doesn't feel all that long ago, but it was more than a decade ago. One, I think, rather important point is that Rio Tinto is within striking distance of the peak from back in 2008. That represented an acceleration from what had been relatively depressed levels only about 5 years previously, whereas it has been holding between about 3,000 and 5,000 now for the last 9 years. So this represents a significant period where not a lot has been going on. I do rather think that it is gold, in particular, which has one of the clearest base formations anywhere. And the fact that it is overbought in the short term, it's not something we can ignore, that there is certainly potential that it could have some pause and consolidation here. But when we see these kinds of markets that don't do anything for a long time, that when they eventually do run, they can really run. And I think that's one of the reasons why people are interested in gold in the first place. So I think it is one of the markets that is particularly worth paying attention to. And if the one important fact about the gold mining sector is they've been through the ringer in terms of trying to reform their businesses, and it's really rather underowned in terms of institutional interest. A significant number of mines have got all-in sustaining costs in the region of $800 to $900, and the price is not far off $1,350. Well, those kinds of margins are not often seen in businesses. They're usually the preserve of the technology sector. So if gold does in fact move higher from here, as long as the gold mining sector does not binge on debt, then it should offer leverage to the gold price, and that's particularly the case in the beginning stages. Eventually, the fact that mines are wasting assets by definition, well, that is going to weigh on boards, and they will start to invest in additional new supply. But we don't have any evidence of that right now, and in fact, the fact that Barrick first bought Randgold Gold Resources, and Newmont is trying to acquire Goldcorp, whereas Barrick is now trying to acquire Newmont. Well, what that is starting to highlight is that the big companies see value in the sunk costs that are already written off in listed miners. That it's a lot easier to buy your competitors than it is to go out and build on new greenfield sites, borrow a pile of money, and then wait for years before the first gold is poured. So there is a race on right now to really become the biggest gold miner out there. But what that tells us about the industry is that ore grades have been declining. The cost of new mines is inordinately high. There has not been a lot of new investment in new mines. Well, those are the kinds of conditions that create a supply inelasticity environment. Well, the one thing that would really ignite it would be a demand story. And there is the potential for a demand story, considering that we know that the response that most governments have to populist movements is to spend money they don't have. So that sets up the potential for competitive devaluations in the currency markets, which is obviously a benefit for the gold price. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.